The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to The History Show on RTE Radio 1. On this week's programme...
Now, in all three parties, there are deputies who rely on the PR system for their seats.
The single transferable vote. We look back at the history of Ireland's voting system 100 years after it was introduced. Also...
Jean Rutnilla Fennell called the nightmare of unremitting pregnancy. I came up with the idea of contraceptives bringing them from the north to the south.
The contraceptive train, memories of 1971 and an important milestone in the struggle for reproductive rights in Ireland. Plus, the Belfast engineering strike, an overlooked episode in our history and an event which paved the way for the shorter working week we enjoy today. It's 51551 for your texts and at RTE History Show on Twitter. We begin this evening with the single transferable vote. January of this year saw the 100th anniversary of Sligo Corporation election of 1919. You might wonder why we would be talking about the Sligo Corporation election of 1919. But it was a significant poll. It was the first time that an Irish election for all the seats in a single legislative body used the single transferable voting system, the system which has become such an integral part and a very exciting and a fun part of Irish political life. Not fun for the politicians, but fun for the observers. To talk about how and why the change in our electoral process came about and why it's still going strong a century later, I'm joined by two guests. Elaine Callanan is lecturer in modern Irish history at Carlow College. David Farrell is Professor of Politics at University College Dublin. You're both very welcome indeed. Elaine, the idea of proportional representation actually came up during the debate over Home Rule, didn't it?
It did. If you go back through the John Redmond papers in the National Library of Ireland, you see he was very busy calculating numbers, population counts, how many Catholics there were in each county, how many Protestants there were. And he was trying to come up with a system whereby minorities could have a voice. And he looked into proportional representation in the single transferable vote. But he came to the conclusion in the end of the day that it wouldn't work because he wanted the unionist minority population in Ireland to have a strong voice than their actual population numbers. So he ruled out the transferable vote then at that stage.
Talk to us then about Sligo Corporation's election in 1919, an election that otherwise would be of no significance and nobody outside of Sligo would be bothered with. It was called for because some weren't happy with the corporation's spending.
Yeah, well, apparently there was a lot of corruption and fraud going on in Sligo Corporation. But the other grave concerns were that Protestants, who were about 15% of the population, were getting no political voice. And the rates that were being charged in Sligo were very high. So they formed the Sligo Ratepayers Association to try and combat these issues. Initially, they worked with Sligo Corporation as it was, but because the rates weren't reduced, they decided to form an actual ratepayers association. And in that ratepayers association, they drafted a parliamentary bill. And Thomas Scanlon, the MP in Sligo at the time, took that parliamentary bill to the House of Commons, and it was passed in July 1918, got royal assent, and became the Sligo Corporation Act of 1918, and that's what introduced proportional representation, single transferable vote in Sligo. So,
and David, internationally speaking, it is an unusual voting system, especially when it comes to voting for the main houses of parliament, isn't it?
It is. I mean, you know, it's ourselves and Malta are the only two countries on this planet that use it to elect their main house of parliament.
And it's used in Australia to some extent, isn't it?
It's used in Australian states for one or other of their parliaments, depending on which state. Sometimes it's the lower house, sometimes the upper house. And it's used for the upper house of the federal parliament. And then you'll see little other areas, you know, Scottish local elections, the Isle of Man. It might be introduced for the Welsh Assembly in the future. So there's pockets of places that use it around the world, but just these two countries that use it for their main House of Parliament.
Where does it come from? And, you know, why did it extend beyond Sligo in 1919? Why did it survive that experiment?
Well, it was invented by an Englishman, Thomas Hare, in the 1850s, and it became quickly known as the English variant of proportional representation. So those continental European countries all adopted their own version of PR, but the British decided this was the model that they would preference if they were going to go and use it. And so they experimented on their colonies. And so we were lab rats, effectively. They tried it out on us, and they tried it out on the Maltese, and they encouraged it in Australia as it was forming its own federation. And, you know, Bob's your uncle, we ended up with it.
And why, Elaine, why did it stick here? Why, the Sligo Corporation election must have been viewed as a fairly successful experiment.
Well, it was a successful experiment. There were 24 seats in the corporation that were up for grabs. 48 candidates put their names forward, and the results actually did give quite a good split across all the various divides. Very, very briefly, you had the Sligo Ratepayers Association, who managed to get 8 seats. You'd Sinn Féin, who got 7 seats, Labour 5, and Independents 4 seats. So you had quite a good representation at that stage. So there was a number of reasons why this was brought in, but the main one was to give minorities a voice, particularly as we move into the Free State element of the story, that, you know, to allow greater
and
minority.
Then in 1920, we had local elections in Ireland, which were in effect the last all-Ireland elections in Ireland. There was a general election in 1921, but I think most of the seats weren't even contested in that election, so it doesn't really count, I suppose. But what happened then in the 1920 local elections?
Well, the 1920 local elections, they're nearly a story in and of themselves, but the single transferable vote was used in this particular election, again, to give minority voice to all people. And it worked out extremely well for the municipal elections. You see quite a good breakdown across many of the county councils. There's some interesting results come out of it, a little bit of shift, for example, in Derry, Londonderry, whatever's your preference for that particular area, where, you know, it was a unionist constituency. And then after the 1920 local elections, between Sinn Féin and Nationalists, they got 21 seats and Unionists got 19. So they were able to kind of shift the Unionist vote out a little bit in that. So, again, it was it worked very well across the country. It was rather different for the rural elections, which happened in June 1920. And then that one, you saw Sinn Féin really sweep the boards in terms of getting all of the votes, which is interesting because some argue that the single transferable vote was brought in to make sure that Sinn Féin didn't get a majority.
In the urban elections in 1920, were Labour standing, or were Labour still waiting, as it were?
No, Labour actually stood in the 1920 local elections, and they did very well, actually, in many constituencies. Between them and Sinn Féin, they both did quite well, but Nationalists held their ground also in the local elections, what the old Irish Parliamentary Party people. So there was a very good division of votes. But then you did see things like, you know, Unionists doing well in Ulster, and, you know, Nationalists doing well in Leinster, and little bits of variances that you become quite familiar with. But overall, there was a fairly good split.
It showed off the strengths.
It showed off the strengths, PR. Yes. Yeah.
Okay, on two occasions, there were attempts to abandon proportional representation in favour of the straight vote, the first past the post system. In 1959, a referendum took place on the proposal. That was defeated. Then in October 1968, another constitutional referendum took place relating to the electoral system, once again proposed to alter the electoral system for elections to Dáil Éireann from PR by means of the single transferable vote to the first past the post voting system. Once again, it was defeated, this time by a much bigger margin. In this clip from RTE Television Archives, reporter Ted Neelan is interviewing then Minister for Finance Charles Haughey during that 1968 campaign.
Now, in all three parties, there are deputies who rely on the PR system for their seats. In your party as well as the other parties, can these deputies be expected to be enthusiastic about changing, getting rid of the system?
Well, first of all, there's no reason why any deputy should suppose that he won't retain his seat under the new dispensation. But the only thing I can tell you is that our parliamentary party recently had a fully attended meeting, and the enthusiasm there was quite exceptional. The only dispute or argument between us was how we could most effectively conduct the campaign.
Right, that's back in the days when we did not have referenda. David, Fianna Fáil was the party interested in reforming the voting system during this period.
Yes, it was a power grab, to put it in, you know, at its finest, really. I mean, Fianna Fáil had been in government, of course, a lot up to 1959. You know, they were the dominant party, but it's worth remembering, of course, that very often they were in a minority government. So De Valera wanted to bequeath, as he went to the presidency, a secure future for his party. So it was a clever tactic to try, and they nearly did it.
And in 59, it was simultaneous with the vote for the presidency,
wasn't
it?
That's right. So it was a close call. They nearly got it. They nearly succeeded.
And why in 1968 was the majority against, do you think, considerably bigger? I think it was over 60% were against the proposal.
Well, if I remember, Elaine will know the history better than me, but in 68, they tied it with a second vote on the same day, as I recall, which was also talking about
constituency boundaries,
which effectively was to try and malapportion the system again to favour Fianna Fáil. And I think that was probably taking it a step too far.
Would you agree, Elaine, a pure power grab?
I would agree. I think what's interesting is in 1959, Éamon de Valera was running for president. So, I mean, it would have given Fianna Fáil a huge control over the country as well. And then if you think of 1968, Jack Lynch was Taoiseach at the time. And again, he was very popular Taoiseach. So I think they thought this was another moment in time where they might be able to switch back into the first-past-the-post system, but they failed miserably, particularly in 1968.
Question from Ray in Kilkenny. He's texted in, wants to know, when voting began 100 years ago, were there voting papers? And in a general election, were there presiding officers and poll clerks in polling booths?
Well, I can answer that. There were polling officers, returning officers, they were actually called then. And yes, people, of course, did fill out ballot papers. Once we moved to the single transferable vote, it was very similar to the way we all go out and vote today for any election. You put your number opposite your preferred candidate, one, two, however number of candidates are on the sheet. And that was done back then just as much as it is today.
David, turns out that the first past the post system, although it's obviously we associated with the United Kingdom, we associated with the British general elections, they have actually in a tiny proportion of instances actually used the transferable vote.
The British
have.
Yes, well, there was a big debate in 1918 about the introduction potentially of single transferable vote for, I think it was about a third of the UK constituencies. And it was quite a close call between the House of Lords and the House of Commons. I think at one stage it lost by about 8 votes. There was a lot of ping-pong in between the two houses. If it had been introduced, we would have had the alternative vote, which is the system used to elect the Irish president for the bulk of the seats, and in the urban areas, single transferable vote. Anyway, when it didn't go through, I think in part as a compromise, if I remember correctly, some of the university seats had it introduced.
Including Trinity here.
Mm.
So we actually had an example of that even before, the year before the Sligo election. In 2011, the UK, David, had a referendum to change their voting system that was roundly defeated, suggesting perhaps that people were very attached to their first-past-the-post voting system in the UK. But was there a little bit of lack of tactical nous, perhaps, on the part of the Liberal Democrats?
I think that then leader Nick Clegg made a tactical error, because if he had gone into a deal with the Labour Party, they would have supported a referendum on the single transferable vote. Instead, he went in with the Conservatives, and they were only prepared to offer the alternative vote, again, the system we use for the presidential election. And the feature of the alternative vote that it shares in common with the first past the post is that it's a non-proportional system. So in effect, it was a referendum about very little of any import whatsoever.
And Elaine, your take on the pros and cons of the proportional representation system?
Well, the big pro for the proportional representation system is that it allows minority parties to have a voice. And the big negative of the proportional representation system is that you can get too many voices. This is why we end up with a lot of coalition. One of the advantages of the first past the post system is that you get a majority government, usually, whereas under proportional representation, you can get a large majority, but then they usually have to form a coalition with somebody else to run government.
But I suppose the argument against that is that they have lots, you know, coalition is something that's, you know, is widespread across Europe, where don't have similar system to ours.
It is. And what it is, what is good for, from our point of view, and what we're seeing even in Brexit, where they're finding so many difficulties, is that we have learned to govern by compromise to a large degree. And that's one thing that proportional representation has allowed us to do as well.
I suppose, David, one of the other cons that you would have noticed over the years is clientelism and the rise of clientelism, where you have people from the same party in the same constituency, something that you don't get in the UK.
Yes, but in truth, there is quite a debate in the academic literature, in the political science literature, about the extent to which you blame the electoral system for the nature of politics in this country. You know, there could be other factors that are in play, because after all, we have other countries that use electoral systems that have many of the same properties of the single transferable vote. Finland and Denmark are two prominent examples, and there you don't find clientelism like we do here. So the argument that it's the electoral system that's causing it, The jury's out on that one. I mean,
would that be eliminated if you had PRSTV in single-seat constituencies as opposed to multi-seat constituencies?
I don't think it would make much difference. I think if you change the electoral system on a Friday to whatever system you like, on a Monday the Irish politicians would do what Irish politicians have always done.
Okay. Elaine Gatherland, David Farrell, thank you both very much for joining us this evening to talk about the history of the single transferable vote, 100 years old. After the break, we'll be hearing Memories of 1971 and a milestone event in Irish feminism.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Time now for another instalment in our occasional series, Here's the Thing, where Julian Clancy uncovers the stories behind objects on display in the Little Museum of Dublin. Tonight, he's taking us back to the early 1970s and recalling an important milestone in the struggle for reproductive rights in Ireland.
There's a great photograph hanging upstairs in the Little Museum of Dublin. It's of a group of women marching behind a banner that says Women's Liberation Movement. It was taken in Connolly Station in 1971 by Eddie Kelly for the Irish Times. These women had just taken a stand against the church and the state. They took what became known as the contraceptive train. But for Nell McCafferty, who's also in the shot, this photograph means something else.
When I see the photograph now of me behind that banner, all you can see is my wee face. Nobody else knows that the night before the contraceptive train, I was having a relationship with a woman and she broke it off. So when I look at that photograph, I say that's the day my heart was broken.
The photograph was taken nearly 50 years ago. And despite a broken heart, it still brings a smile to Nell's face over what was achieved that day.
Yeah, we changed history that day.
In 1971, Nell had just swapped the riots and the protests of Derry for a desk in the Irish Times in Dublin. There were few women journalists at the time, and their work was quite limited, as Nell found out in her first day in the office.
So I said, "Where do I sit?" And the deputy news editor said, "Well, go over there and sit there at the woman's desk, occupied by Maeve Binchy and Mary Maher." And I went over into that town and said, "What am I doing here?" And they said, "You're doing fashion, cookery and babies." And I said, "I don't do fashion. I can't cook and I'm not having a baby. What am I doing here?" It was 4 days before anybody could think of something for me to write.
Nell eventually found her tribe with the Women's Liberation Movement. This was a group of extraordinary women who were determined to fight the inequality they faced every single day at home and at work. In 1971, if you were a woman in Ireland, it was illegal to own your own home or to get equal pay. If you had a violent partner, you couldn't get a restraining order against him, and you couldn't even refuse sex from your husband. However, the group decided to try and tackle one of the biggest issues facing the women of Ireland at the time.
To end what Nuala Fennell called the nightmare of unremitting pregnancy.
In 1971, the average family size was 12, but it was illegal in Ireland to buy contraceptives. But they were available in the north, so Nell came up with a plan to highlight the issue and to get the country talking.
was coming up to International Media Day, and I came up with the idea of contraceptives, bringing them from the north to the south, and we all agreed we'll do it.
That Saturday morning in May 1971, 49 women, including Nell McCafferty, boarded the train at Connolly Station and set off on a journey that they would never forget.
Then off we went to Belfast and came out at the railway station beside the Europa Hotel and straight across the road to a chemist. And I confidently went up to the counter and said to the chemist, I'd like the contraceptive pill, please. He said, where's your prescription? What prescription? Imagine us looking for contraception. We didn't even know you needed a prescription.
As the cameras rolled, the women asked for ointments, creams and jelly, as well as a few condoms. But what they really needed to make a statement and grab the headlines was the pill.
And I came up with the idea of, we'll buy aspirin, dozens of them, because customs officers in those days, to get this recall, had never seen a contraceptive pill in their lives. Most doctors hadn't, most civilians hadn't. And we brought them down to Dublin and went up to the customs officers were there and they said, anything to declare? We said, yes. Maureen Johnson. Boy, she's the kind of woman you'd go into war with her. Oh, she's good. And Maureen went over and said, yes, this is contraceptive jelly. He said, I'll have that, please. She said, no, it's jelly for my belly. You're not having it. It was great. Whereupon we all stepped forward and waved our aspirins and said, no, you're not getting them.
Beyond the customs gates at Connolly Station, a crowd of confused onlookers, supporters and the media had all gathered, eagerly waiting for word about what this was all about.
This is one of my big regrets of that day of the contraceptive train. I had written out the speech to be read when we got to Dublin. But I wanted it to look like we weren't all journalists, because most of the founder members were journalists, and we wanted to look like we were ordinary woman, and I picked this woman, Colette O'Neill, to come and read out the speech. And I wrote myself out of history. God, it would have been a great photograph.
The contraceptive train was in the papers the next day, and the church labelled it as an insidious onslaught.
The next day I was read off the altar in Sligo. I considered that a great honour. I don't know why. I wasn't frightened of the church. Most of us weren't. We just didn't care.
The actual photograph from that day is still up on the wall of the Little Museum of Dublin. For Nell, it's still a photograph that reminds her of that broken heart, but also of proudly stepping through the customs gates at Connolly Station and starting a conversation that would eventually change the country forever.
We could hear them all singing, "We Shall Overcome," and it was joyful.
Julian Clancy reporting there. He was speaking to Nell McCafferty about her memories of the contraceptive train on the 22nd of May 1971. Here's the Thing is funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee. I'm joined in studio by Jennifer Redmond, lecturer in 20th century Irish history at Maynooth University. The Irish Women's Liberation Movement, Jennifer, was kind of short-lived as a group. But given what we've just heard, was it influential in changing people's attitudes?
Oh, absolutely. That was a really powerful PR stunt. I mean, the women who organised it, Nell McCafferty said they're interested in journalism, working professionally as journalists. They knew the power that it would have. What it did was bring to kind of national attention something that had been happening on the ground for a couple of years. So the Irish Family Planning Association had actually been started 2 years before that. And they got around the legislation by giving away contraceptives, namely condoms, because as Nell found out, you still had to have a prescription for the pill. But they would take donations, and that got them around the laws of the land. So there had been people for a few years at that point
trying to do something to break down, you know, moral objections and to point out the farcical nature of the law. But this stunt really did it.
They were fairly innocent times. I mean, the idea of not realising that you couldn't just walk into a chemist shop anywhere and get the pill without a prescription. Well, they were fairly innocent times.
Well, that just actually shows you the powerful nature of censorship at the time, because, I mean, we all know things like famous novels that have been censored, but also manuals or pamphlets that would describe in detail what a reproductive cycle was, how fertility really happened. Those kinds of things had not been in Ireland for decades at that point. So whatever people knew, how they knew it was probably quite unreliable. You know, passed on knowledge, maybe gleaned from some kind of international publication, but it was very poor in terms of openness.
But obviously their hearts were set on coming back with the dreaded pill that they could wave around. So it was a stroke of genius on somebody's part to actually think of, okay, let's just go back with aspirin and presumably take the wrappers off.
Yeah, they took them out of the packet and nobody knew the difference because nobody had seen them before.
Did they succeed in breaking taboos around contraception? They certainly got a debate going.
They certainly did. And I think they did break some taboos because the activists were on the Late Late Show, which was, as we all know, the big taboo-breaking forum. So I think they did. Now, it doesn't say that people suddenly became much more liberal or accepting. You still had another couple of years to go before there was any allowance, for example, for single parents. And even then, it was called something rather judgmental, unmarried mother's allowance, which I think tells you everything about the ideology of the time. But certainly that movement, although short-lived, did make people talk, think and reevaluate Irish society at the time.
Now, Mary Robinson wasn't on the train, but certainly it helped her campaign, didn't it?
Yes, and she was part of the movement, broadly speaking, and then obviously she was active with lawmakers in examining the legal prejudices against women, which, you know, ran the gamut from protections against domestic violence to, you know, selling property to contraceptives, including some really strange anomalies, like the legal domicile of a woman was where her husband was, but if they had separated or she didn't know where he was and he might have been in Thailand, that was her legal domicile. So they were pointing out the ways in which the law did not work any further. And Mary Robinson, of course, then became famous for taking on the state and taking it to the Supreme Court to actually allow for the importation of contraceptives if couples wanted to use them.
How long did it take for birth control to be deregulated, I suppose?
Yeah, so it happened in phases. So it actually took quite some time. The case happened a couple of years after the contraceptive train incident, but the government didn't respond with legislation.
This is the McGee case.
The McGee case, exactly. The legislation didn't come in until 1979. And it wasn't even straightforward then. It really was to preserve the life of women who were having, you know, these perennial pregnancies, and you still had obstacles then to overcome. Could you find a doctor who would actually write you the prescription? Could you find a pharmacist who would fulfill that prescription, etc.? So that was the first stage of it. At least it was on the statute books. But we actually had further rounds of legislation.
So this was the Irish solution to the Irish problem.
Yes, that
was
exactly. That's what Haughey talks about. Yeah, and it was. We could still prescribe the pill as a cycle regulator, in quotation marks, to, you know, unfortunate women. And then that joke came about that women had the most irregular cycles in Ireland than anywhere, if you were to believe the statistics. 48,000 or something by 1979, we're actually using it, if we can have any true sense of it. But you still had quite a long period of time to go before the situation where now you can walk into a petrol station and buy condoms freely. You had quite a number of challenges to that. Don't forget, in between, we had the Eighth Amendment inserted into the Constitution. So there was great fear that these kind of legal steps would go even further.
You teach the history of the contraceptive train in different courses in Maynooth. How do students who would have been, most of your students now would have been born in or around the millennium, the turn of the century or turn of the millennium, how do they react to this?
Well, they love it, for a start. It is street theatre as it was described even at the time. They find it quite funny that, and this is on purpose, the women are very respectable looking, they are dressed nicely, but they're saying quite challenging things, including the famous, no, you can't have my spermicidal jelly. They always laugh at that. But at the same time, they do find it quite shocking that at the same moment in time, you have a sweeping student revolution across the Western world. You have the second wave feminist movement, the civil rights movement, and here's Ireland, it's seemingly very backwards. So they respond very well to the activists teaching it at certain points over the last couple of years. They very much made the connection to the Eighth Amendment. And I think it's actually one of the best things on the RTE site, if I say so, in terms of the archival footage, because it just brings it to life wonderfully.
And how do they respond or how do they react to the fact that it wasn't until 2 years after the incidents that we're talking about that women no longer had to give up their jobs in the civil service when they got married?
Yeah, they find that incredible. They also find it incredible that that, even though it wasn't a law in many private businesses, became the culture. And it became the culture to such a serious extent that it seemed like it was the law. I mean, it was unchallenged. A lot of them would go back, actually, after learning what they've learned in the classroom and talk to their grandparents and ask them the question, well, what do you remember? Or what was your experience? And sure enough, they find, oh, yes, I had to leave my job. Now, there were sweeteners put in along the way. So, for example, from the civil service, you were given a marriage gratuity. So some women actually didn't mind so much because it helped them set up their new homes. It was a substantial amount of money. But the students themselves, they do wonder that's an eternal question, I think, that historians pose. Why was Ireland so conservative for so long? And that actually intrigues them massively.
Does it interest them, the fact that that would not have changed in 1973 had it not been for the fact that we joined the European Economic Community?
Yeah, I'm very quick to tell them that, because I wouldn't like anyone to have the impression that suddenly we became, you know, radically liberal-minded overnight unless we were forced into it. I don't think it would have happened.
Jennifer Redmond, thanks for joining us this evening to talk about the contraceptive train in 1971 and the struggle for reproductive rights in this country. After the break, we'll be talking about a significant but overlooked episode in Ireland's labour history when workers in Belfast went on strike for a shorter working week.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
51551 for your texts, and we've had a text in from Fergus Whelan, Raimel, I beg your pardon, excuse me, to point out that the 1968 PR referendum took place after the Civil Rights March in Derry, which demanded PR. There have been many significant centenaries in recent months, events that have been recounted and analysed by this show and many others, from the armistice to the 1918 general election, and of course the meeting of the First Dáil in January 1919, and just today, that pivotal Sligo local government election in 1919, which used PR. Well, we're going to look now at a very significant centenary that hasn't got as much attention. It's an episode that heralded a big reduction in the length of the working week, affecting the lives of countless thousands of working people in Ireland and Britain. During World War One, workers in all industries had to accept long hours and low pay. And with the war over, and as the demands on industry eased, many workers were determined to achieve better conditions and a shorter working week. And in January 1919, there was a massive industrial strike in Belfast. It practically brought the city to a total halt as thousands of well-organised engineering workers staged a walkout. The strike lasted for 4 weeks. Shops and factories closed, trams stopped running, bread ran low, and the British Army was ultimately called back in to take control of power stations. To talk about this, I'm joined in studio by historian and author Pádraig Yates. Pádraig, you're very welcome back to the History Show. What kind of hours were people working in 1919. So First World War is over. That emergency is over. What kind of hours were they still working at that stage?
Well, during the war, they were working a basic week of 54 hours. And a lot of people would be doing overtime on top of that. So you're talking about a minimum working week of probably 60 hours. And because wages in the war never caught up with inflation, or did maybe to some extent at the very end, people had to do overtime simply to pay the bills. And that applied in Belfast as much as anywhere else. So in August 1918, the unions, the engineering unions, put in a claim for a 44-hour week. And there was protracted negotiations. And then eventually, towards the end of the year, due to pressure from the government, the employers agreed to concede 47 hours. And there was a ballot. It was a very low ballot. About a third of the workers bothered to vote. It was narrowly accepted across the United Kingdom. But two places rejected it. One was Clydeside and the other was Belfast, which were the two biggest centres of shipbuilding in the United Kingdom at that time. So it was serious. The Clydeside workers, the Workers' Council there, actually wanted a reduction not of to 44 hours, but to 30 hours. And the thinking behind it was not simply that they were tired working these enormous hours, but there were all these men coming back from the front. There were nearly a million men demobilised by the end of 1918, and they were still coming back at the rate of 10,000 a day. And you've got to remember that that Britain mobilised nearly 6 million troops from within the United Kingdom. So there's huge numbers coming back. There were about a million and a half women, over a million and a half women, doing jobs which had previously been done by men.
So there was plenty of scope for the reduction of hours.
Well, they needed it if they were going to reabsorb these people into the workforce. And was the Red Scare. The Russian Revolution wasn't that old, and it seemed unstoppable. You've got to remember, it wasn't until 1920 that the Red Army stopped advancing either east or south and west. So there was a genuine fear amongst employers and the ruling class. And Lloyd George sold the idea of shorter working hours for the same money on the basis that it was insurance to stop revolution.
Okay, go back to World War One, and you would have thought that unions would have had employers over a barrel during the war because there would have been huge labour shortages. And if you look at agriculture, farmers, Irish farmers in particular, were able to parlay shortages and parlay the war into increasing their own incomes. Why was that not the case with workers?
Well, it was the case with workers, and wages did go up. It took a long while to catch up with prices. But there was a deal done. The British government very consciously took a decision that they couldn't fight the Germans and the trade union movement at the same time, because the whole of the United Kingdom had been disrupted by non-stop industrial strife, really, from about 1910 until the outbreak of war, nearly. So the deal was they would give unions recognition in the workplace. There was de facto union recognition. And in return, the unions would agree not to strike. So when you got to the deadlock situation where the employers wouldn't give any more, the unions wouldn't settle for any less, both sides had to agree to binding arbitration. And that worked more or less up until the end of the war. It was beginning to creak by then. But interestingly enough, during the war, union membership in the United Kingdom doubled from 4 million to 8 million. In Ireland, it trebled because of this system of union recognition. And by the end of the war, what was happening was workers were dissatisfied, they weren't getting more. So who do you blame? Well, you don't actually blame the employers, you blame the union for not coming back with a better deal. By the end of the war, there was a very powerful shop stewards movement in Britain and in Belfast, not in the south, because unions here were very small and your local general secretary lived around the corner. But in Britain, they were very remote from the workforce. So you had this huge shop stewards movement built up. So in places like Clydeside and in Belfast was this huge dissatisfaction. We want a better deal and we couldn't care less what you've negotiated. We're coming out on strike and now the war's over. No one can stop us.
Right. Okay. So just to go back to the fact that all over the UK and in Ireland, 47 hours a week is accepted, except on Clydeside and except in Belfast. And in Belfast, the general election is called, and it's called for December, but there's a mass meeting before the election actually takes place, after it's announced and before it takes place. Tell us about that meeting.
There was a meeting in the Ulster Hall of the engineering workers or their representatives, because we couldn't take them all. But at that meeting, they invited all the candidates to come. It was the day before the election. All of the Labour candidates, bar one, attended. All of the Unionist candidates attended, including Sir Edward Carson.
Who was standing in a Belfast constituency.
None of the Sinn Féin candidates turned up. And Joe Devlin, who was the only nationalist MP for Belfast, sent a note apologising for not being able to attend. But he said he had a slight cold, which was his way of saying, I'm not interested.
Why did none of the Sinn Féin candidates turn up?
Because they knew 90% of these workers were Protestant and loyalist. So they'd be wasting their time going. Or they'd probably be afraid of a lot of hostility as well, but it was indicative. We people tend to sell the National Revolution as being very progressive and egalitarian and that, but it was actually quite conservative and still rooted very much in the past. So they basically wrote these people off. There was another complicating factor in Belfast, which was that quite a lot of shipyard workers had gone to the war. I mean, Workman Clark, the wee yard, as it was called. George Clark, the owner, the managing director, marched 500 or 600 of his employees down to the recruiting office when war broke out, and they all joined up. He didn't. He went back to work. But a huge chunk of his workers went into the British Army, and there was a feeling, which we don't know how real it is, a lot of work needs to be done on that. There was a feeling that Catholics had replaced all these men. So there was that fear as well. When we come back, are all our jobs going to be taken by these Catholics? And what are they going to do? Are they going to insist, well, we're here now and we've got to stay? So there was that tension underlying it on top of the constitutional issue of, are we in the United Kingdom or are we not in the United Kingdom?
So you have 20,000, I mean, it's incredible to think now, 20,000 shipyard workers in Belfast.
No, you had nearly 30,000 in Harland and Wolff. You had another few thousand in Workman Clark.
Right.
And then you had altogether probably about 40,000 engineering workers when you add in the engineering shops. You've got to remember over 80% of all the ships built in Ireland were built in Belfast. Over 40% of all the goods manufactured in Ireland were manufactured in Belfast. It was completely different from the rest of the island.
And in fact, I mean, Belfast at around that time or a few years before that, I think sometime in the 1890s, had superseded Dublin as the most populous city in Ireland. So it was actually bigger than Dublin at that stage. So the strike begins then on the 25th of January. And is it one issue? Is it, we want a 44-hour week, that's it?
Yeah, it's very much a one-issue strike. They had a ballot actually on the 14th. And that's where they all marched into the city. They lined up on Queen Street in, where the shipyards are, marched across the Albert Bridge, through North Belfast, accumulating more members as they went. So 40,000 workers ended up outside City Hall, and they had a rally there, very disciplined, no disorder whatsoever. And in fact, the chairman, J.J. Hill, at the end of the meeting said, I want every man to be in work at 6 o'clock in the morning. It was very disciplined. They all went off and balloted then, overwhelming ballot strike action, and they all were in work again at 6 o'clock in the morning. But again, on the Saturday, 25th, they all came out as they said they would. And not only did they come out, but the engineering workers in the power plant and in the sewage and waterworks came out as well. So the city suddenly ground to...
So it was effectively a general strike.
It was a general strike. Right. And 20,000 other workers in the linen mills, men, most of them women, couldn't go to work because there was no power. And eventually on the Sunday, they realised they had to get power to places like hospitals. So they agreed to limited power being supplied, but no company could tap into that for commercial purposes. And the only violence that occurred was the next day when the Belfast Telegraph and a few city centre businesses tried to access the electricity. And when the lights came on, they were stoned and had to close again. But apart from that, the strike committee ran the city. They even had, the government even agreed to the appointment of special constables who were all strikers, who would patrol the city and make sure nobody used power illegally, and that law and order was kept.
Okay, two questions occur arising out of what you've just said. The first is that on Clydeside, their troops were sent in. They attacked the strikers. There was violence. That did not happen in Belfast.
No, it didn't, because, again, getting into Irish politics, Hackett Payne was the commander of the British garrison in Belfast, the British Army commander. He had been a senior commander in the UVF before the war, joined the army, became a general officer, came back, and he worked hand in glove with Dawson Bates, who later became notorious as the enforcer for the Stormont government when it was set up. But at that stage, they were both in regular contact with Carson and Craig in London, the unionist leaders there, who were in touch then directly with Lloyd George and with Bonner Law, who was obviously very sympathetic towards them. And they said, look, you keep the troops out of Belfast. These men are not a threat to the system in any way, so long as they're treated with respect.
Did they police the whole thing themselves?
They policed they actually had more control over Belfast than the Limerick Soviet had in Limerick.
That was my second question.
Yes.
Question was, was this a Soviet? Because the Limerick Soviet is famous, but there were actually dozens of Soviets or Soviets around the country during this period. Was this, in essence, a Soviet?
Well, it depends what you mean by a Soviet. I mean, Soviet.
I'm not sure what I mean by a Soviet.
Well, a Soviet, as far as I know, I'm not an expert, but it's only a Russian word meaning council. So if you had a workers' and peasants' council, it was like a local authority in Russia.
Well, I think in Limerick they did call it a Soviet.
They did, yeah. In imitation of Russia. Mm. But it wasn't actually running the city. It was running the strike, and it was providing food and helping people with transport and all the rest. But it was, I mean, famously, as one American journalist said, you know, they stopped for the say the novena, you know, at 6 o'clock in the evening, and the when the I can't remember her name asked the question of the bishop, you know, what do you make of these communists who are, you know, saying decades of the rosary on picket duty? And he said, well, they're Catholic communists, so they're okay. So, well, these were Protestant communists, if you like, who probably were not okay with the bishop, but the politically, this was never a challenge to the state. And the unionists had the sense to realise, if we send the troops in here the way they were sent in Glasgow and there is blood spilt, we could lose control of
this. So this wasn't Red Clyde. This was not Red Belfast.
But they held out longer than Red Clydeside, which settled about 2 weeks nearly before they
did. They get any support from Dublin?
They were offered support from Dublin. They were offered support. In fact, Dublin did benefit to this extent that the council in Dublin, the councillors who were mainly Sinn Féin and Labour councillors, actually voted to give their own staff, the manual staff, the 47-hour week in case the strike spread south. And the ITUC, the Irish Trade Union Congress, offered to bring out other workers in support of Belfast. But interestingly enough, the Belfast workers wouldn't let the women out, and they wouldn't form alliances.
When you said they wouldn't let the women out, they didn't want them to go on strike.
Yeah. Well, in a sense, it was the Edwardian or Victorian notion of manhood. You know, we'll fight this battle, and when we win, you'll all be looked after, and we'll make sure you're looked after too. But it's women shouldn't really be on the picket line in the way that men are. So it was very much asserting their masculinity, if you like. But also there's a very common sense argument that they would have to be laid off if there was no power, and they could go and get unemployment benefit. If they came out on strike, they wouldn't be eligible for it at all. So why go on strike? So it was a combination of things. But in a way, more significantly,
good Ulster pragmatism.
Well, of a sort. Yes and no, because they wouldn't allow the railway workers offered to come out. But because some of them were in the transport union, they were seen as suspect, they were influenced by, they were secret Sinn Féin, so we don't want to be tainted by that. So it was this classic, if you like, Ulster or Belfast Protestant working class. You can't put them in a, you know, you can't, they're square pegs and round holes. You cannot pigeonhole them the way, they don't suit the nationalists because they're a complete aberration. Don't treat the socialists for the same reason, and the unionists prefer to forget about it.
How did it end?
It ended with them going back, a very orderly return to work after 4 weeks. Lord Pirrie, the shipping controller for the United Kingdom and the biggest shipping owner in the world at that time, said he would call all the other employers together and see if you could get them all to accept the 44-hour week, that he was willing to give it, but only if all the other shipyards did. He couldn't get them together. It ended in October 1920 with a few minor concessions, but by then you had the pogroms. And funny enough, the man who led the strike was Charlie Mackay, a member of the Carpenters Union, who was actually a Catholic, and he was expelled, along with a lot of the other strike committee, as unreliable in July 1920, when the pogroms began.
Okay, the pogroms, an entirely different story. Yes. We don't have time to go into to them at the moment, but we will, I think, hopefully we will come back to those before the end of the current run. And Pádraig Yates, thank you very much for joining us this evening to talk about that pivotal Belfast engineering strike of 1919. That's all we've got time for this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as our podcast, are available on our website, rte.ie/history. Thanks tonight to Cara O'Hare on sound and our researcher, Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, for me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.